The Scrabble Go Guide to Learning New Words. Quizzical, your dad's face when he hasn't got enough vowels. Skeptical, your mom's face when you try to say small is a word. Belligerent, how your brother feels when he doesn't win. Vocabulary, what you all build when you play Scrabble Go together. Everyone's a winner with Scrabble Go, the fun brain training game you can play with family wherever you are. Available on Android and iOS. Download Scrabble Go today.
And what I believe is when we're doing this, it's not an original thought. When you do the deep breaths and slow exhales, you're literally pulling your consciousness up into a higher consciousness, a higher vibration, a higher intelligence, and you're vibrating at that level. And I believe you're tapping into a portal of an electromagnetic field of limitless ideas, solutions, creativity, inspiration. That's what I really, truly believe is happening.
The genie show, oh, how long it takes.
Hello, my friends, and welcome back to The Genie Show. I'm super, super excited that you spend each and every week listening to this podcast, especially in how you invest your time into listening to this podcast. Time is our most valuable asset, yet some of us are caught up in the day-to-day to realize just how we're spending it. You know, unlike money, we can't just put time into a bank account and be guaranteed an interest rate or be guaranteed more of it. How we quantify our time is by just from how present we are when we're spending it. Today's guest on The Genie Show spent 11 years of her time, yes, 11 years of time, as chief of staff for Oprah Winfrey herself. I would actually say that's quite a valuable time investment if you could work alongside someone as amazing and influential as Oprah Winfrey. Her name is Libby Moore, and she is an amazing human being. She shares her experiences around money and also around how we use our power. Now, this was something that I took away from this conversation, especially because how we invest our time is just as important as how we invest our power. It kind of goes hand in hand when you think of it. If you're giving away all of your power to someone else, if you're giving away all of your power and attaching everything to a certain outcome or a situation, your feelings, mood, your day, your time, to be precise, is governed by the outcome or an attachment to a certain situation or person. So what that translates into is we're spending our time everywhere outside of the present. So time is just being spent unintentionally. Now, I know as human beings, if we were to apply that to money, we would be a lot more cognizant of where the money is going because we keep track of where our money goes. So it's a lot more quantifiable that way. But how we give away our power, who we give it to, what situation we attach our power to really does prove to be a compass of how we spend our time. So my friends, I'll hand it over to Libby Moore. She'll drop a whole lot of wisdom on sharing your power, using your power, and our most valuable asset, time. And welcome to another episode of The Genie Show. Genie Sarah Spidey here as we unpack the daily habits, the mindsets, and the lessons people have learned in their lives to create the happiness that they have today. Joining me on the show, I'll give you let her do the introduction because I don't think she needs an introduction. Her name is Libby Moore. She dreamed of being a writer at Saturday Night Live, and she worked her way around, and fate found that she landed working as chief of staff for none other than Miss Oprah Winfrey. She's joining me today, and I'm absolutely delighted to have her on the show. Libby Moore, thanks for joining me on The Genie Show.
Thank you, Jenny. I'm so excited to be talking with you.
Back at you, Libby. Libby, there's so much I want to talk to you about. You've had an absolutely fascinating background. But before we dive into, you know, what you did and where you got to where you are today, I'd love to ask you a question about your morning routine. One thing I loved about talking to you the other day, which I did share with a couple of friends and close people in my life, one thing you asked me was, what's your intention for the podcast? And it sounded a lot like one of our teachers, Oprah Winfrey. I'm wondering what your morning routine is. How do you start your day?
Okay, this is how I start my day every single day. First thing I do is I live with my partner, and one of us makes celery juice, if you've heard about the celery juice craze. Yeah.
I'm forgetting the name, but it's in that book, Medicine. What's it called?
the medical medium, Anthony Williams.
That's exactly, it was on the tip of my tongue. Yeah, I have absolutely heard of that. Tell the truth. How does, that must really wake you up.
Well, it's not like a delicious concoction. It's straight up celery juice, but it makes you feel really good. It's a great way of starting your day, live, vibrant food, right? It's a juice. And then we meditate for about 20 minutes and then go into journal writing. So for me personally, my routine is celery juice, get back into bed, meditate for 20 minutes, journal. And in after the meditation, it's prayer and or intentional thought, creative visualization, and then journaling. And then I start my day.
I'm fascinated too, Libby. When did you start this morning routine and have you tweaked this over time?
Definitely. I started meditating in about 2008. And when I say started, it means a friend of mine had given us a book called Catching the Big Fish by David Lynch, the director, the film director. And it's a little book. You can read it in one day. But the number one thing that stuck out at me, jumped out at me, I should say, is in every film contract he has written into the contract that the production will stop for 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon for him to do his meditation. He does transcendental meditation. And he feels that through this meditation is where he gets all of his ideas, creativity, on and on and on. That one sentence, that one or two sentences is literally what made me start doing meditation. So I didn't really know how to do it at the time. I just sat in a chair and would close my eyes and try to do three deep breaths and slow exhales in a row without my mind wandering. And after the first time, you know, your mind is off. Like, I got to pick up my dry cleaning. I forgot to call that person, blah, blah, blah. And then you bring it back and start over at breath number one and slow exhale. And pretty much to this day, 11 years later, that's still how I meditate. There's no specific form, even though I've been trained in transcendental meditation, but I simply just close my eyes, deep breath, slow exhale. But back to your question, I tried to meditate 2 days in a row, skip 2 months. Oh, then I do 5 days in a row, skip 6 months. You know, so finally, once I got into the routine of it, I realized that this was benefiting my life and I could think clearer and be more calm. And so it became a routine in my life. And the journaling, I would say I started probably around 1998 when I read a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. Started doing the morning pages. So that was kind of my journaling. And then creative visualization, my aunt gave me a book called Creative Visualization by Shakti Gawain when I was 21 years old. And I was blown away by the concept that you could imagine in your mind what you wanted or what you wanted to be in the future. And you could actually bring it into fruition and to manifest it in your life by doing that. So those three things started at different points in my life and eventually I brought them all together. And so I'd say solid for the past. So probably the past 9 years, every morning, meditation, prayer, journaling, intentional thought.
Libby, you said that, you know, one of the greatest gifts or what meditation has helped you do is give you that sense of calmness and clarity. What other value has meditation and this morning routine brought to your life?
For me, it's consistency. Again, what I realized is when I was working with Oprah, that job was 24/7 for 11 years, and it was phenomenal, as you can imagine. It was just the best professional and personal experience of my life. It was just stunning in all ways. And the caliber of responsibility was so high on a daily basis. The stress level was very high on a daily basis. So I worked with a team of 5 assistants, and together as a team, we managed, scheduled, coordinated her personal and professional life. So it wasn't like I was the only one doing it. But I realized when I would not meditate in the morning, when things went wrong, I was kind of out of my mind or like scrambling all over the place. Where when I did meditate in the morning, I felt much more grounded, calm, clear. And what I believe is when we're doing this, it's not an original thought. When you do the deep breaths and slow exhales, you're literally pulling your consciousness up into a higher consciousness, higher vibration, higher intelligence. And you're vibrating at that level. And I believe you're tapping into a portal of an electromagnetic field of limitless ideas, solutions, creativity, inspiration. That's what I really, truly believe is happening. So even if someone said to me, Libby, that's not real, on my deathbed, if someone said, well, that's not real, you're making that up, I would say, so be it. Because I believe that, it created this extraordinary life that I led. That's my belief.
Wow. Libby, what I'm hearing from what you've kind of described is you seem to have an amazing ability to just surrender. A lot of people, I know I struggle to surrender and kind of be like, all right, whatever happens, happens. Because I know that, you know, your life, the way you live your life is like you just follow your heart every day, wherever that takes you. And that takes a tremendous amount of being able to practice surrender. How have you gotten to that level? Seems like you're almost, I would say that you're at a level of mastery if you're able to practice that daily.
I don't know that. I can only speak for myself. Because I do coaching. I coach people. I do executive coaching and life coaching. And I say to every client, number one, there's no finish line. I'm still working on this in my own life on a daily basis. There's no like, oh, I've crossed the finish line. I'm perfect. You know, that doesn't exist. So I think even people that we look to in life, you know, whether it's Oprah or the Pope or these extraordinary people that have accomplished so much and are so evolved, they still are working on it in their life. They still are human beings working on it and tweaking it and refining it and making it stronger. And you did say, how did you learn that? And it, honestly, it's through trial and error. And even today, I'm 53 years old. Sometimes I am flying high. I feel like, yeah, I've got this. I'm in flow. And then something happens. I'm like, whoa, what just happened? So, but it really truly has been through trial and error. And when seemingly bad things happen, which now in hindsight, I don't look out as bad at all. Like when I think about my career prior to Oprah, I think I got fired twice and laid off once from a job. Now in those moments, I was so angry and I couldn't believe that happened to me, you know, and oh my God, it was just the worst thing in the world. But in hindsight, I can look back and say, wow, what an amazing stroke of luck, because I hated those three jobs that I was in, but I didn't have the courage to step out and leave or the motivation to find another job and then leave. So the universe just said, okay, you're not going to do it, so we're doing it for you. You're fired, basically. And that pointed me in the right direction. So instead of continuing down the road in the wrong direction, the universe, God, source, whatever you want to call it, higher vibration, higher intelligence, just kind of like course corrected me to get me going in the right direction. And ultimately, those right directions led to Oprah. So I love talking about that because almost everybody's been fired or laid off at least once in their life. Or they're going to be. And if they can hear the story and remember it in the back of their head that it was a blessing that that happened to me every single time it did, then they know that that's a blessing for them as well. So it's really trial and error. Even like, you know, when I was working with Oprah, it was a fantastic paycheck, fantastic bonus, fantastic perks. You know, I mean, as you can imagine, she's a wildly generous person. I had no debt. Yeah. I had savings. I had everything, you know. And when I chose to leave, I felt really good. I was like, I'm fine. I've got plenty saved up and blah, blah, blah. And then at some point over the past 8 years, I went all the way down, like into credit card debt. And I like talking about this because I think that, you know, with social media today, everybody looks at people like they're perfect and they just keep going up, up, and up. And, there was a point because I chose to take my savings and reinvest it back into myself, starting my own business. There was a point where I went through that and went into credit card debt. And, you know, at one point, my younger sister said to me on the phone, Liv, you don't have to live in a cardboard box on the street to prove to people that you can bounce back from zero. You know, because I kept saying, like subconsciously, I felt like people thought, you know, Oprah's just like, here's like millions of dollars. You're amazing. Like, and, you know, that wasn't the case, obviously. And just going for it and taking a leap of faith and starting my own business and really going all the way there and then, you know, turning that cruise ship around in a canal and doing it really quickly to show people how quickly it could be done. So I've been there and back.
Wow. Well, I really like the fact that you said that you're happy to be really raw and authentic about this story, given what people are putting out there on social media, you know, assume perfection and happiness for everyone. Yeah. So that was a really authentic story. It's almost like, I mean, you said that when you were working with Oprah, there seemed to be like, you know, you were saving, you weren't in debt, but it kind of went the other way when you left. It's that trial and error thing when you kind of experience this experience are too extreme, you have more context on what actually works for you. Did you find that?
Definitely. And I do want to say that it wasn't like because I left, I went all the way there, you know, into the negative balance. It's not because right. I left. I could have done it differently, for sure. I could have not gone all the way there, but I feel like there was something subconsciously in my mind, in complete honesty. I believe that there was right. something in me that was thinking that people would just assume that I left her after 11 years and I have all this money and I don't need to work, because I would hear that a lot. Even some of my friends and people that are meeting, like, oh, how is it being retired? I was like, I am not retired, you know, like, Nick, yeah. I left at 45 years old. I wouldn't even want to retire if I had the money to retire. But the point yeah. is that I started seeing people kind of looking at me like, oh, just assuming I'd pick up dinner, or like just assuming because of the association with Oprah that I had all this money. And I was certainly very comfortable, but it wasn't like I could just retire. So I feel like subconsciously I thought I need to go all the way down to the bottom to show people and prove to people that like I'm just like you and I've been there too. And this right. is how we're going to get out of this together. I cannot tell you the amount of people that I'm coaching that have started businesses and they look phenomenal on Instagram or their website or this or that, or, you know, they're on panels and they're doing talks and yet they are freaking out because they have no money. You know, but that's not the image that's been portrayed. And I believe that if we all talk about this more honestly, then everyone can say, oh, okay, well, I'm on the right track. I'm headed in that direction. I understand. And then there's the whole process of like how I did bounce back, and I share that with people. And it is our thoughts create our life, period.
I'm curious, when you said that when you worked for Oprah, there was this assumption that you know, were well off, and it's kind of like that assumption by association that people kind of expected that you'd foot the bill. I mean, did you have to learn to draw boundaries and speak up about generosity? Because I know Oprah in her talks about how, you know, learning to say no, and that's a full sentence, it's quite an empowering thing to do, but sometimes yeah. can also be difficult. How did you mm-hmm. learn to draw those boundaries around your abundance and generosity, I guess?
Well, I honestly didn't learn how to draw boundaries until I left the job, ironically, you know? And the other thing is, I love being generous. I am a generous person. To me, I enjoyed doing that. I felt like I wanted to take my friends out or family out. I wanted to treat people and give great gifts because I had the means to do it. You know, I wasn't married. I don't have kids that are going to colleges. Like, I was in a really good position and I enjoy it. For me, it would be more enjoyable to give someone something or take them for fabulous experience than for me to go buy, you know, a high-end like handbag and shoes or something. That's just, or a new car. Like, it's just, that's where I get my joy, is giving. So I don't feel that people took advantage of me at all. You know what I'm saying? I think that people just, it was more when I left, and I think that people just assumed that I had kind of been quote unquote set up for life. And it was how they would talk to me, like, oh, are you enjoying being retired? And I was like, what are you saying? Like, I want to work and I want to work.
Gotcha. No, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense, Libby. And I guess also when you spoke up and said, you know, I actually want to work and I need to work as well, it kind of puts things into perspective as well. You know, when I was doing some research on this interview, I read about an experience you had when you were working at a cleaning company. This was obviously before Oprah. You started working for Oprah as well, where, you know, you knocked on an executive's door and asked to empty her wastebasket, and she kind of yelled at you and said, you know, who do you think you are? And, you know, how dare you do this? And the beautiful thing about that experience, or your reaction to the experience, should I say, rather than the actual experience, was that instead of taking that anger or that bite that she gave back at you and continuing that resentment throughout the world, you actually steeled yourself and said, I'm going to be in a position one day, if a cleaner knocks on my door and asks to clean up my office, I'm going to ask them how their day. So you actually took it a step further. That's a beautiful example of kindness. So that also was kind of, that innate nature of kindness was within you. Did you, I'm curious to know, did that actually happen? When the cleaning lady knocked on your office door, were you able to do that?
Okay, I love you so much for asking this question, because it's not one that people would ask a lot, and I love the story. Do you mind if I retell that story?
Please do. I'd love to hear it.
Okay, great. So I was 25 years old because I went to college outside of Boston, worked for a couple years there. Then I moved to Boulder, Colorado. I thought, I just want to ski for a year. My parents were freaking out. I can't believe you're leaving. You know, you're just starting your career and now you're going off to ski. And I said, oh, I know. I think it's something I have to do. So moved to Boulder, Colorado with some friends. And I did odd jobs for 2 years, from 23 to 25 years old. And that means I walked dogs. I cleaned houses. I was a receptionist at Remax of Boulder. I worked at a place called Boulder Salad Company, chopping broccoli and carrots and lettuce in a like refrigeration case all day, handing out chocolate chip cookies. I worked at the movie theater. I was 23, 24, and all my coworkers were 15. So I was the only one with the license. I would like drop off these kids who are my coworkers after work. It was kind of funny. And one of the jobs I had was working with a cleaning crew at night in a very big corporate office. I think it was called US West. It was like a big telephone company and their headquarters was outside of Boulder, Colorado. So let's say there's 12 people. We break into groups of two and we clean this entire massive corporate building. So you'd go into the bathrooms, you know, clean the toilets, mop the floors, everything. Then you'd go into the executive office, my team member and I, we'd vacuum the floors and empty the waste paper basket and dust, you know, the computer screens and stuff. So this one night, it's about, and I think our shift was 9 to 11 p.m. I'm in the executive area, big glass office, and I see this woman working at her desk, and I knock on the door. And I open the door, and I said, excuse me, may I empty your waste paper basket? And she snapped. She just looked up from her computer and said, who do you think you are? When you see me in this office, you never knock on that door. I'm a very important person. And wow. You, when you see me in here, you keep that door shut. And Ginny, I was shaking. My hands were shaking. Wow. She just, and you know, I don't know what was going on. Who knows? Maybe she was going through a divorce. Maybe she was about to get fired. Who knows? I have compassion for the woman now.
Yeah.
30 years later. But at the time, yeah, exactly. At the time, I think it was 25. I said, I am so sorry. I apologize. That will not happen again. I shut the door and I really was shaking because she really just scared me. And as I turned to walk away from her office, this thought crossed through my mind. So it wasn't me consciously thinking this. This thought crossed through my mind and the thought said, someday you are going to be a big executive in a glass office. And when the maintenance person comes around, you are going to stop and look them in the eye and ask them how their day was. It was like, boom, it was 3.5 seconds. It shot through my mind and that's it. I forgot about it. It wasn't like something I was anticipating or imagining in the future. It was a thought that came and went. I was 25. 10 years later, at 35 years old, I got the job with Oprah when I was 34. I turned 35 about 4 months later. I'm in my office. I used to work until anywhere from 10 to midnight that first year, just trying to get my head around the enormity of this job. And the maintenance guy comes by. He knocks on my door. Now, I didn't remember this moment in that immediately. Knocked on the door, opened the door. Hi, my name's Billy. What's your name? Libby. Can I empty your trash? And I said, yeah, come on in. And then I just started chatting with him. And that was kind of our routine. When he would come, I'd say, how are you doing? It's like, oh, Libby, I'm good. I've got a great job that I absolutely love. My wife loves me. We've got kids that are healthy. God loves me. I love my life. I'm good. How are you? He would say that every single time. And my point is, when I was, you know, busy and in my head so stressed, he was reminding me on a daily basis when I saw him and I would say, how are you? He reminded me about what's important in life. He was like a prophet. I didn't think this until later, but he was like a prophet who was just reminding me every day, this is what's important in life. So at some point after that, I remembered that I had like a flashback to the time that I was the maintenance person and that thought crossed in my mind, someday you're going to work in a glass office, which it was a glass office. And when the maintenance person comes along, right? Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Wow.
We all have that. I'm sure you have stories like that. I'm sure the listeners have stories like that. If you could just think back and you start to piecemeal it together, and again, back to your thoughts create your life, I believe there's also things that are lining up for us that we can't even be aware of yet. I mean, Oprah used to say, once you decide, and I'm paraphrasing here, she said, once you decide, this is what I'm going to do, or I want to do this, you know, you set your goal and you decide, yes, I'm going to do this. She said, the universe will rise up to meet you there. So I think that's a really interesting concept and so true. Like, where did that thought come from when I was 25? How did that part of me know that 10 years later, I would be in that exact position?
Wow. That's so very true, how when we declare something or realize something in our heads or in our words, and how it kind of manifests naturally or is manifested, you know, right before us.
The Genie Show.
What's the best mattress for you? Well, if you're an egg or a kitten, check out the competition. But if you're a human person, put your body on a Nectar mattress. As well as award-winning layers of comfort, you can sleep easy knowing you got incredible value. Mattresses start at just $499, and you get hundreds of dollars in accessories thrown in, as well as a 365-night home trial and a forever warranty. Go to NectarSleep.com.
The Genie Show, oh, our lonely days are gone.
I think one of the things that I read too is you said that, you know, you learned that to be yourself was kind of a very, very powerful tool in leadership. And I 100% agree. I think if you be yourself, you set the tone and the space for the rest of the company underneath you to be themselves too. And you create that safe space of, okay, you're yourself and I accept you unconditionally for who you are. And we can talk about things in a safe space if, you know, anything gets uncomfortable or anything like that. I read too that, you know, another powerful tool that you found, not necessarily in leadership, but just in everyday life, is not to give away your power. Talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Well, where that came up was another thing that happened soon after I had started working with her. So I was about 6 months into the job, working around the clock, exhausted. And I'm not going to go into the details of what happened, but there was a coworker that I was working with, someone on her team, and we had this big kind of blowout over something. And I felt that this person was very entitled, and it felt like everyone was just kind of working around this person, like whatever this person wanted, even though it wasn't like they had a very high title or what their role was, but there was this person carried a lot of weight, you know, and was very influential. So we had a head-to-head, this person and I, and the Monday after this kind of blow-up happened, I came in always privately to her, you know, wouldn't be in front of people. I said, I don't get it. Like, this person, I feel like they're running, you know, this, and this, and why do you give them so much power here, and da-da-da-da. And she listened to me very calmly. And she said, Libby, you are my chief of staff executive assistant. You run and manage my executive office. You're managing my life. If you believe that this person has more power than you, then they do. I mean, if you look on the org chart, they don't. But if you believe that they have more power than you, then you've just given your power over to them. You've just handed them your power. Stop giving your power away. Yeah, that's what I said, Jenny. I was like, wow, I just have chills on my arm right now, just remembering that moment.
I'm getting goosebumps too. I'm getting goosebumps as well. That's like, wow.
Yes. And Jenny, then that, it really sunk into me. Every single person listening to your podcast right now has had at least one, if not 100 or 1,000 moments like that. Right? All of us. And I also see how that happened with partners, you know, former relationship, not all, but some that I was in, I was just giving my power away. Yeah. Whether you feel like that person's smarter than you, or has more experience than you, or they're more dominating, you know, energetically than you, or whatever, just stop giving your power away. It's a wildly empowering thing to just put an end to that, to do your best to put an end to that.
Coming to think of it too, Libby, I'm like reflecting back on relationships that I've had too. I'm like, I just gave away my power so easily. And I thought it's attributed to the fact that I too consider myself to be quite generous as well. I think generous people likely to fall into that pattern of behavior because they have the energy of give, 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 and what can I do for you? So giving away your power may come hand in hand in that. I haven't done any tests or experiments, but I'm assuming that could be a case as well. But it's something that is so natural. I guess it comes from a fear of taking certain sense of accountability as well, would you say?
I think that may be part of it for some people. And also, yeah. I believe it's us playing small. So when I'm working with people, yeah. coaching with people, every moment, I don't know who said the quote, life isn't happening to you, it's happening for you. When you look at things through that perspective, it's usually an opportunity to step into the fullness of who you are right now in this moment, not who you were at 25 or 15 or 6 years old, right? Because we're all kind of operating from this old paradigm of who we were as a kid and these dynamics, but to really who you are now. And I think for some people, even beyond accountability, it's like easier. Even though we say we want to be all strong and powerful, it is easier to continue the default of just defaulting back to who you were in your family dynamic or in this work dynamic and playing small. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. It's when we shrink ourselves to make other people feel comfortable. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, exactly. It's like a meeting where, if you know, in some cases you can see it all the time where women are talking blah, 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 and then the guy comes in or some guys come in and they speak with authority and their voice changes a little or they shine their light a little dimmer. It's like, why do we do that? That doesn't make any sense at all. It's like, this person, their energy is in the room, so now I'm going to be smaller. No, you step into the fullness of who you are today gracefully.
Absolutely. That makes perfect sense. And I think also the shrinking yourself. I think Marianne Williamson summed it up perfectly, and I don't want to paraphrase her amazing quote, but, you know, shrinking yourself or, you know, giving away your power does not serve anyone, especially you.
That's right. Yeah.
Libby, another thing that drew me to your story when I heard you on another podcast was obviously as a member of the LGBTIQ family, you know, you have a story of coming out as well. And, you know, I was really touched when I heard your coming out story, obviously 20, 30 years ago. I'm not aging you or anything like that, but obviously a while back coming out wasn't as really, I guess, it wasn't as a natural progression as it is today. And I hope one day we're in a post coming out world where we don't have to sit anyone down and declare anything. I hope mm-hmm. it can be as ease and grace as it is when you fall in love to say, hey, I've fallen in love with someone. So that's kind of the vision that I have for the world. But talk to me about your journey in coming out, because I know that I guess having the amazing career that you had, this may be a topic that you don't get to talk about as much, or maybe you do, but I'm wondering, talk to me about your journey of coming out, because I did hear a little bit about it on the other podcast, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it now. Okay. Where do you see this coming out phase, or I shouldn't say phase, coming out stage in someone's life taking, or do you think it's going to be a continual thing?
I love that question so much, Ginny. I'm so happy you asked me that question, because it's not something that people ask a lot. So it organically comes up in my talks that I do, but I like to ask that. So for me, I believe that there's a continual, to answer your question, I believe there's continual coming out. So for me, it was coming out the fact that I'm gay. So I knew it, oh my God, as long as you can remember. I know it's different for everybody. And for me, I think at least by fourth or fifth grade, I thought, oh, I have crushes on girls. And then on the playground at that time, I mean, I was, you know, I was born in 1966. I'm 53. So in fifth grade, the worst thing you could say to someone was, you faggot, you dyke, you lesbo. That was the worst thing in fifth grade. So that's when I started realizing, I'm pretty sure I know what those words mean, and that would define who I am. So this, I feel this way naturally, so I should be quiet about this and just be quiet about this. And then as I got to sixth, seventh grade and really had crushes on girls, I thought, oh, okay. And everyone's like, who's your boyfriend? Who do you have a crush on? I'm like, oh, okay, I'm keeping this a secret. By the time through high school and college, I thought, I know I'm gay and I will go to my grave with the secret. So I went to college in 1984. And at the time, it was not, like you said, it was not as easy to come out at the time. And for me, probably in 10th, 11th grade, I started suppressing my feelings with food and alcohol and numbing myself with food and alcohol. By the time I got to college, I gained, oh my God, so much weight. I weighed 205 pounds and I was a size 20 by the time I graduated because I got an associate's degree from college. So I'm a size 20. My mom would take me to a store called The Forgotten Woman that had size 18 and above in a mall. And it was just horrifying. I just felt like, because I wasn't myself. And I was surrounded. I was about 60 or 70 pounds bigger than I am now. So that's seven dress sizes. You know, my friends from home were just like, hey, wow. Like everyone's looking at me so much. I had gained so much weight. And no one knew the real story. I didn't even really understand why I was drinking and eating so much. But I knew that I was gay and I knew that I would go to my grave with a secret. Well, by the time I was 21, I think it was like months after I graduated from college, it just that suppressing from so long, you know, suppressing truly the truth of who I am, had taken its toll. And I just felt like I couldn't do it anymore. And then one night I was out with friends and I had way too much to drink. And as I was driving from one point to another point, it was the middle, you know, it was late at night. It was pouring rain. And I just thought I should just end my life. Like I really had this moment of like, what's the point in living if I can't be myself? And if I can't be with the person that I really want to be with, date like a woman. And I thought all my friends would think I was gross or my family would not accept me as a gay person. So the reason why I'm saying all that now is I understand how detrimental it is when we allow these thoughts to spin in our head that are not true. So that night I put my foot on the gas in this moment of just being totally out of my mind and just thought, what's the point in living? And long story short, before I got to this hairpin turn, I slammed on the brakes and tried to turn the wheel because something in me said, what are you doing? Like a voice. It just said, what are you doing? And I kind of snapped out of it. And I tried to take the corner, but the car jumped the curb and slammed into a tree. And I totaled my car. I survived because I had just put my seatbelt on 15 minutes before when I heard the DJ on the radio say, it's raining cats and dogs out there. It's not letting up anytime soon. Buckle up for safety. And I never wore my seatbelt ever. But for whatever reason, I just put my seatbelt on, not knowing what I was about to do 20 minutes later.
Wow.
So I did not come out until 6 years later when I moved to New York. This was after Boulder, Colorado. Moved to New York. I got a job as Maury Povich's assistant, who is the U.S. talk show host, Maury. And this is way before he was doing Who's Your Baby Daddy, which I think is what his show is now. But he's a phenomenal guy. And he did a show called Coming Out Strong. And I went into his office, locked the door, watched the in-studio feed, and watched him interview these five gay women who I could relate to. And I, in my mind, I was 27 years old, and I said, my God, I've felt this way most of my life. 98% of what these women just said, I felt my whole life. I am gay. And then I came out to my best friend 2 days later. Yeah, that was my coming out. And it changed my life. And the weight slowly melted off of me once I came out. And that point, Jenny, was when my career started to take off. My whole life changed once I had the courage to tell the truth.
Wow. So it was kind of Oprah's advice, which you would receive years later, of the best gift you can give anyone is to be authentically you, is kind of what you stepped into at that moment.
Absolutely. Because up to that point, even if you're, let's say, coming out, let's not even call it like, you know, when you start dating someone and everybody's on their best behavior, and it's like, this is amazing and we get along so well. But and then you start tweaking who you are because it's like, oh, they don't like this, so I won't do that. And then if you keep doing, acting like you're someone that you're not, eventually you get sick of it. Like, I don't even feel like myself. Who am I? Because you're trying to be someone that person wants you to be, even though that's not who you are. So then you have to have your own personal coming out of like, this is not who I am. So if we just start relationships from the beginning, right, of just being ourselves, either we're going to peel away from each other or we're going to fall deeper in love with each other because we're being ourselves. And for me, coming out, like I told Maury, he was one of the first people I told. I said, you probably heard through Jake that I came out. He was like, no, I had no idea. And he's like, oh my God, I hope I haven't said anything to offend you over the past year. I said, no, you've been amazing. And he said, if you told your parents, I said, no, this is like a dry run telling my dad. I'm seeing how it goes with you first. And then I'm going to tell my dad. And he was great, you know, my Mari, and then my parents. So, and ultimately they were both very supportive and just said, I love you no matter what. We want you to be happy. I do think it was very hard for my mom because she had to mourn the loss of what she saw my future to be. But I understood she needed to go through that. And now she's, you know, many years, she's been phenomenal. But I do believe that everybody has their own personal coming out. It's not just about being gay, bi, you know, or trans.
I 100% agree with you. I think there's something that we all have to sit down and declare to people, as not just always about sexuality.
Right.
I guess just to kind of wrap up, I'd love just to hear your thoughts. I mean, we've had a really insightful conversation, and I think we need to have a part two because you're such a joy to talk to and such wisdom that you have to share. I'm wondering, Libby, if you could define happiness, your own personal definition of happiness, what would it be?
Such a good question.
The loaded one.
I would say it's truly being comfortable in my skin, comfortable with who I am and who I'm with, and truly feeling like I'm giving something to the world. You know, that I matter. This, what I'm doing here matters. It's creating a positive ripple effect, whether it's within my family, my friends, my community, and rippling out from there. That truly, to me, is the ultimate happiness. I feel like I'm being of service in some positive way in the world and comfortable being who I am, which I am very comfortable with who I am now.
And it's such a service to the world too when you are completely yourself. Libby, thank you so much for joining me on the Ginny Show. I've had an absolute ball talking to you and hearing about this, the wisdom that you shared, and you just dropped the microphone so many times there, and I'm like, it just was amazing. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ginny. And I do want to do a part two. Can we please do a part two?
Absolutely. We are doing a part two. When you're in New York in person, we'll definitely have to sit down in studio and do a part two.
I would love that. And thank you so much for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure. So thanks so much again, Libby.
This is Acast Recommends. Every week we pick one of our favorite shows, and this is one we think you're gonna love.
Let's get real. Have you ever wondered why adults are so obsessed with Disney? I'm theme park journalist Carly Wiesel, and on my new podcast, Very Amusing, I'm discussing every story, secret, and shenanigan I know to bring you an inside look at what's really going on there. From secret spaces like Disneyland's private $15,000 dinner to surprising celebrity hot takes, we're covering all of your curiosities. Subscribe to Very Amusing with Carly Wiesel now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast is home to the biggest podcasts from the U.S. and around the world. Subscribe to this show and hundreds more now via Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.